Dr. Fergal MacInruchtig is author of Language Resistance and Revival. He has expertise in oral history and the Irish language and is currently a postdoctoral researcher at Queen's, as well as his other job promoting Irish in the community here, where we are working together as part of a project to chart the almost 30-year history of Féile an Phobail. Agus is féidir go rá, we'll chunker Hannah Fein ag an dégris agus an fuinneamh ag an fhearsa orinne agus ar an áit. Fergal's academic work has looked at how Republican prisoners learned Irish and how that experience informed the broader experience of revival in the Irish language here. In the last month, we saw the launch of a new archive of that revival over the past 60 years or so. Cartlan na Gaeilge Beo, as it's called, will be held across the road at St Mary's College, and it charts many years of struggle for language rights and recognition, in which we might also discern once more how cultural activity from below translates into resilience, energy, empowerment for communities. Fergal will discuss the difficulties in the encounter between the state and the Irish language movement here, and how the language itself might be seen as a catalyst enabling social and political change. Can you please give him a bull of us?
Grammy Magus and Curry, which doing the event on August morning, honour to the council of Shaw and Octagon, no catch by the show. Tipwe has touched it, Igmihal or Noya say I agree. And I want to apologise firstly for the notes because usually I wing this, but if I don't have notes, I'll speak for 3.5 hours from time of best. I put her into some type of order. I wanted to start off by talking about culture. Kenyan anti colonial activist Ngugi wa Thiong'o famously wrote, "The real aim of colonialism was to control people's wealth, what they produced, how they produced it, how it was distributed, to control, in other words, the entire realm of the language of real life. Colonialism imposed its control through the social production of wealth, through military conquest and political dictatorship. The most important area of domination, however, is the mental universe of the colonised, to control through culture how people perceive themselves and their relationship to the world. Because economic or political control can never be complete without mental control." And I think this echoes the famous phrase that Steve Biko had when he says, "The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed." Because anywhere where cultures and languages that were indigenous came into conflict with colonisation, they were seen as a bulwark to those aims. It was mentioned earlier on that Ireland was very much the guinea pig for the British imperial project on a global scale. So in the 1830s in Ireland, the tally stick, or the bat of scour, which was donned upon the neck of Irish-speaking children, who at the time never knew any English, became a badge of humiliation. So at the end of the day, kids would be beaten or punished physically in accordance with the amount of times they had spoken the Irish language. By the time this tally stick made its way to the community of Ngugi wa Thiong'o in Kenya in the 50s, the tally stick had become a button which would be passed around the classroom to the children who had been caught speaking in Gwahuyu or Swahili. At the end of the day, they would walk around the yard with a placard on their neck saying that they were stupid or they were dunking. And what this was about doing was inculcating inferiority complexes in the oppressed. And this is why, in the Irish context, by the end of the 19th century, nobody wanted to admit that they could speak the Irish language. Or as Douglas Hayes famously says, the Irish speaker became like the abominable snowman. And in the 1881 census, people were afraid to admit that they could speak the Irish language because it was linked psychologically with barbarism. And this is why people like France Fanon, the Algerian revolutionary, would talk about the need for thoroughgoing decolonisation. And for Fanon, there was three stages. Stage one, that the colonies would recognise that they had been completely subjugated and assimilated. If they could recognise that, they could move to stage two, where they would begin a process of national reawakening through a cultural revival. If that could be successful enough, they would go to stage three, which would be the fight and the battle for national independence. That's why people like Fanon says, "To fight for national culture means in the first instance to fight for the liberation of the nation, the material keystone which makes the building of a culture possible." So I would argue that in Ireland, what happened in the revolutionary period corresponds with people like Fanon was talking about. So when the Gaelic League, the GAA was founded in 1884, it became the fastest growing sporting organisation in the world, with 1,000 GAA clubs and parishes across this country by 1890. Conruith na Gaeilge, or the Gaelic League, became the fastest growing cultural movement of its kind in Europe, with over 80,000 members at the turn of the century. The famous Irish rebel or leader of the Easter 1916 Rising Podrick Pearce would famously say, when the Gaelic League was formed, the Irish Revolution began. And Pearce himself would be the first exponent of Irish medium education, which we'll talk about in a way. He talked about the British education system being a murder machine. And he talked about, for the first time in the Irish context, about decolonising the mind through education. And I want to just return to this concept of liberation again. When we think through what happened in Ireland in the aftermath of the Anglo-Irish War, when we had the imposition of two conservative states in Ireland, this whole idea of liberation, and Martin O'Kane would talk about this. He was arguably one of the most prominent cultural and political critics of the state in Southern Ireland. And what he says was that the proclamation of 1916 had been betrayed. He says that if people in Dublin still reside in slums and people in the Gaeltacht-speaking regions of Connemara couldn't put shoes on their feet, then the whole idea of liberation had been a fraud. And one of the things that he did before losing his job, because of, he lost his job as a teacher because of his connections with the Irish Republican Army. During this period of time, he formed a group called Muchir na Gaeltachta. And what Muchir na Gaeltachta did was campaigned in Connemara for economic rights for poor Irish-speaking people. And what they were arguing was the language, like Fanon, couldn't be divorced from wider political issues, because within the context of colonisation, any attempt at cultural revival is explicitly and overtly and unapologetically political. So what they did was, they organised a cycle from Connemara to Leinster House in 1935 to campaign for good land for people from the Gaeltacht regions. The De Valera succumbed to their demands, and the Gaeltacht region in Meath, Rathcarn, was founded and remains there to this day. O'Kane would also find himself incarcerated in the Curragh camp in the 40s for 6 years, in a concentration camp where he began to teach and promote the Irish language, and he formed a Gaeltacht hut where people would learn the Irish language, and he would set in motion a model of learning and a model of cultural resistance within incarceration that would be used again and again thereafter. He also founded a group called Mishnach, and what they were doing was using public protest and direct action to highlight the fact that the state in the south had failed to promote the Irish language. He made his way to Belfast, to come and Clonard, which is about a mile from here, a cultural hub for Irish speakers, in 1864. And in a famous speech, he says that the survival of the Irish language wouldn't be created by people from Belfast relocating to the Gaeltacht, but by doing it in your own locality. In 1966, he spearheaded a week-long public fast in Leinster House, where Irish speakers were on hunger strike for a week to prove that the state hadn't promoted the Irish language. The cohort in Belfast who had recruited as a branch of Mishnach held the same hunger strike in Cumann na Clonard. But crucially, the concept of building their own urban Gaeltacht was finalised and thought through during this week. Gaeltacht Wuhershoy, about 2 miles from here, was completed in 1969 without a penny of state subvention. The idea was simple. They would buy their own plot of land, build their own homes and raise their own children as speakers of Irish. Now, of course, to do this in the northern state was to be an avowed enemy of the state, because in every decade of the 20th century, draconian legislation, like the Special Powers Act, was used to imprison without trial people who promoted and used the Irish language. So when they wrote to the old Stormont Ministry of Education in 1969 saying they were thinking of setting up a Gael school or an Irish school, they were threatened with incarceration. By the time the school was founded in 1971, the conflict had ensued and it was in a no-go area, so the threat couldn't be implemented. But these Gaels didn't remain in their own housing estate, because on August 14th and 15th, 1969, when the state pogrom ensued and hundreds of people in these areas were burnt out of their homes, aided and abetted by the police force of the state, what the Gaels decided to do was go down and rebuild those homes, because they had the practical experience of building their own Gaeltacht. And within 1 year, they rebuilt an entire street without a penny of state subvention, despite the fact that they were being attacked on a daily basis by loyalist mobs on the one hand, and being threatened with court proceedings from Belfast Corporation on the other hand. But it didn't stop there, because they also came to my own area, the Upper Springfield area, in the early 1970s. And they came to our area because it was recognised as one of the poorest wards in the north of Ireland. And they set about a process of founding community cooperatives. Garage to a football, Ballymurphy Enterprises and White Duck Industries were amongst the projects that they pioneered, where employment was created for local people in a self-sufficient manner. one of the primary activists of this period and the founder of this cultural centre here, Seamus McShane, was shot 5 times by loyalists as he managed the people's garage. And very luckily for our community, he lived to fight another day. But the philosophy of self-help and na habre jani, or don't say it, do it, as they described it, will provide the bedrock of cultural and community resistance practices in these parts for the remaining decades. And as he's been quoted from twice already tonight, I may as well join the party. One person who was greatly motivated by what happened in the Shaw's Road Gaeltacht was a young man called Bobby Sands. At the time, he found himself in the cages at Loncash, and he was reading Frantz Fanon, and he was reading Paulo Freire, and he was locating his newly acquired Irish language fluency within the international politics of decolonisation within Paris in 1968, the anti-Vietnam War movement, the anti-colonial struggles in Africa. And he wrote a famous poem, Igbunu Gaeltachta, where he says what was happening in the Shaw's Road was nothing other than a political, social and cultural revolution. And he inquired at why people in communities weren't following their lead and joining what they were doing. At this time, he was greatly taken by the writings of Republican socialist Liam Mallows, who argued that the Republic, the government of the Republic, is and must always be a reality. For Sands, that Republic was on the Shaw's Road Gaeltacht. Of course, after 5 years of a bitter blanket and no wife protest, he would lead a hunger strike to the death. He would be the first of ten who would die, and of course it would have a transformational impact on public consciousness not seen in these parts, arguably, since the 1916 rising. But people began to follow his lead, and people who would be released from incarceration, my own father amongst them, would view the Irish language as a way to mediate the struggle for cultural change. And of course, the fact that the Shaw's Road Gaels had provided a platform, had provided a cultural reference point, and an effective working model that people could join and follow was the cultural tipping point in many ways. And in areas like these, people began to found nursery schools of their own accord. Now, what was strong about them is that they'd be independent from church and state. The power would lie with communities who would be increasingly empowered themselves through active participation. And of course, the impetus wasn't limited to the Irish language revival. We had the Falls Women's Centre, which is just down a road here, which my own mother helped to found. Conway Mill Community Education Centre, the People's Theatre, the West Belfast Festival, Failure of Football, which has got a plug from Michal and from Carl already. And the commonality amongst these, what they were developing a bottom-up approach that challenged demonisation and exclusion, celebrated working class resilience, internationalised the struggle for freedom and for justice, reinstated pride and self-esteem, but key to it all was that it fostered a participatory bottom-up activism. There's 5,000 young people currently being educated through a medium of Irish in the north of Ireland. In 1971, there was 9 children. I came through the system myself, and I was amongst the first to attend Manschool first year, the North's first Irish medium school, which was established in this very building that we're standing. We're actually in the old examination hall. So we're sitting, this is where we did our exams, and this was the assembly hall. But I can remember it was the first year coming to the school, and we were told that the school wouldn't receive state funding. And the battle lasted for 7 years, and it was a day in here I was in detention, and I was told that I would be going along to meet with the British government as a representative of the peoples. I was a second year at the time. I would speak in Irish and have my words translated, and at that time we met with a guy called Michael Ancram, who was an emissary of Maggie Thatcher at the time. And he says that there would be no Irish medium education, there were primary schools, but secondary schools were too costly, were too complex, and it wouldn't happen. And I put my hand up, because at one point he says, if you people are so interested in speaking this language, why can't you go to one of the grammar schools in West Belfast and learn it as a foreign language, the way you would do French or Spanish or something? And I put my hand up and says, well, excuse me, I never passed the transfer test, so I wouldn't be eligible. And he says, well, unfortunately, young man, some kids have ability and others don't. So, of course, he was a charming man himself. However, College to First Year today moved to Beachmount House in 1989. It became a litmus test for the emerging peace process, where this whole idea of equality and a party of esteem was mediated through the campaign that happened here at Manschool First Year. Because if this school and the people who were attending this school couldn't be treated as human beings, then how could there be a peace process? College to First Year now is a mile up the road, has 600 pupils, is the biggest, is the largest Irish medium post-primary on the island of Ireland, and is currently undergoing a £15 million extension and renovation. But nothing stays the same and everything changes. And anywhere where great achievements have emanated from the bottom up, they eventually, when they eventually become bestowed with some rightful form of recognition, comes the ever-present dangers of co-option, assimilation and institutionalisation. Cooperation and collegiate approaches between activist groups can end up through a process where competitive squabbling happens for funding from the state's table. I've argued before that we all face the same challenges as the narrative in some way tries to find its way into the mainstream without becoming mainstream. As activists claw with their fingernails for every inch of progress, development and acceptance, while at the same time trying to keep community buy-in, participation and the radical edge that can sometimes be lost. Paulo Freire, the Brazilian educationalist, talks about this when he says, ask the question, can we be strategically inside and ideologically outside? Or are we going to end up stuck in the mud, walking like them, talking like them, and dressing like them? In the Irish language movement and the wider West Belfast community sector, we'll walk the tightrope of drawing down these resources that we're entitled to, but at the same time trying to find creative and radical ways to write our own agenda and shape more liberating future trajectories. One of the things that I've argued in recent times that this could involve reclaiming the values that were espoused on the Shaw's Road, the cooperative values that were espoused on the Falls Road, because those activists warned us at the very start to become overtly dependent on state resources, to quote Joshua Fishman, would be tantamount to succumbing to slow-paced euthanasia rather than death by the firing squad. Their example, I would argue, and their brave, groundbreaking voices of resistance are still carried on the shoulders of the current generation of activism. Of activists who are trying to make our own history under circumstances existing already given and transmitted from the past. And again, bringing this back to the debates that we've had and some of the discussions that we've heard up to now, is that communities and movements in places like Belfast and beyond are challenging in their own diverse and creative ways. They're challenging socioeconomic inequality and cultural assimilation. And I have a wee quote here that I often use from a Maori activist who, in a way, I think would sum this up. Tawai Smith says, the past, our stories, local and global, the present, our communities, cultures, languages and social practices, all may be spaces of marginalisation, but they have also become spaces of resistance and hope. Gurmeet Mwangi.